Escuelas Oficiales de Idiomas de Andalucía. Comprensión oral. Inglés. Nivel intermedio B2. Tarea 1. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Example.
Extract 0.
The world's first malaria vaccine, produced by the British pharmaceutical company GSK, is to be used to help children across much of Africa, following pilots in 3 countries. The World Health Organization has endorsed its widespread use.
Extract
1.
We have COP15 in China. That's going on right now, and the focus there is indeed biodiversity at a time when our natural world is undergoing some of the most severe scarring and change in, well, billions of years. Those achievements that you list are very impressive, and people should not be cynical about them. But what would you say, yes, Elizabeth, to those who argue there is a fundamental tension between development and conservation? And in many parts of the currently poorer world, the priority is development and getting richer, and conservation can come later.
This is a major lesson we need to learn, because what we are saying is there need to be coexistence between economic development and environmental protection. Countries need to develop, and indeed development is key, but that should not be at the cost of environmental management.
Extract
2.
And scientists have identified the UK's oldest meat-eating dinosaur. The chicken-sized creature lived more than 200 million years ago in what we now know as South Wales and the Bristol Channel.
Extract
3.
COP26 is coming. Ahead of the event, we'll have some fresh ideas for tackling climate change.
We can make things that absorb and avoid massive amounts of CO2.
Revolutionary new fertilisers.
Longer-lasting batteries.
And hydrogen-powered heavy machinery.
You'll find that it runs exactly the same as the standard product.
And one of America's most influential green voices, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
We all have to work together, that is the bottom line, and to take politics out and just say, we got to save the world.
I'm Tom Heap.
And I'm Dr. Tamsin Edwards.
Join us for the new series of 39 Ways to Save the Planet.
Next Monday to Friday lunchtime at 1:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Extract
4.
An inquiry by MPs has described the government's early response to coronavirus as one of the UK's worst public health failures. The study by 2 Commons committees found that both ministers and scientists waited too long to bring in lockdowns last year, costing many lives. A government spokesperson said that it never shied away from taking quick and decisive action to save lives, protect the NHS and bring in restrictions. Our health correspondent Jim Reid has been examining the report's findings.
Extract
5.
The government's chief scientific adviser, Sir Patrick Vallance, has said there's a window of opportunity after the pandemic to ensure that science becomes central to political decision-making. Speaking to Radio 4 in his first in-depth interview since the virus reached the UK, Sir Patrick explained how the scientific approach to problem-solving could improve policy development. He said this could prove vital when tackling future crises such as climate change.
This is a moment when the whole of Whitehall is rather receptive to the notion of more science being present, and it's something that needs to be built on during this period when you can do it quickly. And I think that's exactly what we need to do, and engineering as well. I mean, systems thinking and systems engineering is a very important discipline for some of the problems that we face, including, of course, how you deal with net zero.
Extract
6.
Senior black scientists have told BBC News that they believe UK research is institutionally racist and contains systemic bias. A study found that black people accounted for just 1.7% of research staff, about half their representation in the general population. The president of the Royal Society, Professor Adrian Smith, described the situation as unacceptable. Our science correspondent Palab Ghosh has more details.
The latest data shows that black scientists drop out in greater numbers at every stage of the career ladder. 6.5% drop out shortly after the start of their research, compared with 3.8% of white students. Some senior black scientists believe that the research system in the UK is institutionally racist. Chris Jackson from Manchester University, who's one of the very few black professors in the UK, said that at the heart of the problem was a fact that scientific leaders believed that there was no discrimination because they themselves were progressive and liberal. But he said that this view blinded them to the fact that racism and racists persisted within the scientific community.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas.
Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Example.
Extract
0.
The world's first malaria vaccine, produced by the British pharmaceutical company GSK, is to be used to help children across much of Africa, following pilots in 3 countries. The World Health Organization has endorsed its widespread use.
Extract
1.
We have COP15 in China. That's going on right now, and the focus there is indeed biodiversity at a time when our natural world is undergoing some of the most severe scarring and change in, well, billions of years. Those achievements that you list are very impressive and people should not be cynical about them. But what would you say, yes, Elizabeth, to those who argue there is a fundamental tension between development and conservation? And in many parts of the currently poorer world, the priority is development and getting richer, and conservation can come later.
This is a major lesson we need to learn, because what we are saying is there need to be coexistence between economic development and environmental protection. Countries need to develop, and indeed development is key, but that should not be at the cost of environmental management.
Extract
2.
And scientists have identified the UK's oldest meat-eating dinosaur. The chicken-sized creature lived more than 200 million years ago in what we now know as South Wales and the Bristol Channel.
Extract
3.
COP26 is coming. Ahead of the event, we'll have some fresh ideas for tackling climate change.
We can make things that absorb and avoid massive amounts of CO2.
Revolutionary new fertilisers.
Longer-lasting batteries.
And hydrogen-powered heavy machinery.
You'll find that it runs exactly the same as the standard product.
And one of America's most influential green voices, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
We all have to work together, that is the bottom line, and to take politics out and just say, we got to save the world.
I'm Tom Heap.
And I'm Dr. Tamsin Edwards.
Join us for the new series of 39 Ways to Save the Planet.
Next Monday to Friday lunchtime at 1:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Extract
4. An inquiry by MPs has described the government's early response to coronavirus as one of the UK's worst public health failures. The study by two Commons committees found that both ministers and scientists waited too long to bring in lockdowns last year, costing many lives. A government spokesperson said that it never shied away from taking quick and decisive action to save lives, protect the NHS and bring in restrictions. Our health correspondent Jim Reid has been examining the report's findings.
Extract
5. The government's chief scientific adviser, Sir Patrick Vallance, has said there's a window of opportunity after the pandemic to ensure that science becomes central to political decision-making. Speaking to Radio 4 in his first in-depth interview since the virus reached the UK, Sir Patrick explained how the scientific approach to problem-solving could improve policy development. He said this could prove vital when tackling future crises such as climate change.
This is a moment when the whole of Whitehall is rather receptive to the notion of more science being present, and it's something that needs to be built on during this period when you can do it quickly. And I think that's exactly what we need to do, and engineering as well. I mean, systems thinking and systems engineering is a very important discipline for some of the problems that we face, including, of course, how you deal with net zero.
Extract
6. Senior black scientists have told BBC News that they believe UK research is institutionally racist and contains systemic bias. A study found that black people accounted for just 1.7% of research staff, about half their representation in the general population. The president of the Royal Society, Professor Adrian Smith, described the situation as unacceptable. Our science correspondent Palab Ghosh has more details.
The latest data shows that black scientists drop out in greater numbers at every stage of the career ladder. 6.5% drop out shortly after the start of their research, compared with 3.8% of white students. Some senior black scientists believe that the research system in the UK is institutionally racist. Chris Jackson from Manchester University, who's one of the very few black professors in the UK, said that at the heart of the problem was a fact that scientific leaders believed that there was no discrimination because they themselves were progressive and liberal. But he said that this view blinded them to the fact that racism and racists persisted within the scientific community.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas.
Este es el final de la tarea 1. Tarea 2.
Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Extract 1.
My guest is Tracy Emin, an artist who's always put her own life at the center of her work. In drawings, paintings, videos, sculptures, and installations, she tells very personal stories. But you do paint a lot. What is it about painting? What is it? What is the sense of emotion or response to a situation that you can express through the painting?
Okay, so I have always painted. I did my MA at the Royal College of Art in painting.
Do you think the painting has been overlooked?
No, I think I've been overlooked. I think people didn't understand the seriousness of my work over the last 20 years. Like my films, okay, someone said to me, oh my God, I saw your film, Why I Never Became a Dancer. I didn't realise how serious it was, you know.
Extract 2.
My paintings are really robust and really physical. I mean, like, really charged up. When you load a brush up and you paint, it's like being a conductor or something. It's really full of energy, and it's almost like the life force, all the energy comes through you when you put the paint on. So I haven't been well enough to do that over the last year. And to be honest, I've only really just started working again. I had sort of like a brain fog for so long. That seems to have lifted now. And I've started to be re-energized and rethinking about my work. And like, when I start a whole new body of work, it's not just seeing the image. It's also like starting a new conversation with myself about something that I didn't understand before.
I think you said, and you probably said many times, that art saved your life. Mm.
Extract 3.
When did you first hear David Bowie?
When I was really young, probably when I was about 12.
Was he a influence on your work?
No, it was the other way around, wasn't it? With art, he really loved my art, and, you know, I really loved his music. But he did, this is, sounds silly, but because I can't sing a word, I can't sing a note, and he'd say to me, I could get you to sing. We could do a song together. I've got a perfect song that you could sing. I said, I can't sing. He said, yes, you could. And I always wish I'd done it now. It would have been brilliant.
Was he
it?
Serious? Did he have a song for you?
Yeah, he said, I've got this perfect song, and I really wish I'd done it, because at least I would have had something else in history with my association with him. And also also regret not being an extra with my mum on Fools and Horses.
Only Fools and Horses.
Yeah.
Television comedy show. How would that have happened? What was
me and my mum were in Margate sitting on a bench eating some jelly deals, and the scout person came and asked us if we would be extras. I would love to have been an extra in Fools and Horses with my mum.
Why did you say no then?
Oh, I don't know. Extract 4. If I had a family and children and everything, my children were at school and stuff, I'd have to self-censor. But I haven't. My whole childhood, I had no barriers. I could do whatever I wanted. And it's been like that throughout my life as an artist. I have done what I want to do. I have decided as I'm older, if my work isn't going to be hung in the best museums in the world because it's about taboo subjects, then so what? It doesn't matter. My art still exists and I will continue to make it. And about the subjects that I think are important, even if they're the subjects that you shouldn't be speaking about or talking about, because they're still there. They're within the ether. And if they're not brought to the surface, then they implode and there is an even greater problem.
And what's driving you on now to make more work?
Art, again, is looking after me, taking me forward. And also, I hope love is taking me forward too. So I never had so much to look forward to in all my life.
Tracy Emin, thank you very much.
Cool.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Extract 1.
My guest is Tracy Emin, an artist who's always put her own life at the centre of her work. In drawings, paintings, videos, sculptures and installations, she tells very personal stories. But you do paint a lot. What is it about painting? What is it? What is the sense of emotion or response to a situation that you can express through the painting?
Okay, so I have always painted. I did my MA at the Royal College of Art in painting.
Do you think the painting has been overlooked?
No, I think I've been overlooked. I think people didn't understand the seriousness of my work over the last 20 years. Like my films, okay, someone said to me, oh my God, I saw your film, why I never became a dancer. I didn't realise how serious it was, you know.
Extract 2.
My paintings are really robust and really physical. I mean, like really charged up. When you load a brush up and you paint, it's like being a conductor or something. It's really full of energy and it's almost like the life force, all the energy comes through you when you put the paint on. So I haven't been well enough to do that over the last year. And to be honest, I've only really just started working again. I had sort of like a brain fog for so long. That seems to have lifted now. And I've started to be re-energized and rethinking about my work. And like when I start a whole new body of work, it's not just seeing the image. It's also like starting a new conversation with myself about something that I didn't understand before.
I think you said, and you probably said many times, that art saved your life. Mm.
Extract 3.
When did you first hear David Bowie?
When I was really young, probably when I was about 12.
Was he a direct influence on your work?
No, it was the other way around, wasn't it? With art, he really loved my art. And, you know, I really loved his music. But he did, this is, sounds silly, but because I can't sing a word, I can't sing a note. And he said to me, I could get you to sing. We could do a song together. I've got a perfect song that you could sing. I said, I can't sing. He said, yes, you could. And I always wish I'd done it now. It would have been brilliant.
Was he
it?
Serious? Did he have a song for you?
Yeah, he said, I've got this perfect song. And I really wish I'd done it, because at least I would have had something else in history with my association with him. I also regret not being an extra with my mum on Fools and Horses.
Only Fools and Horses?
Yeah.
The television comedy show. How would that have happened? What was
me and my mum were in Margate sitting on a bench eating some jelly deals, and the scout person came and asked us if we would be extras. I would love to have been an extra in Fools and Horses with my mum.
Why did you say no then?
Oh, I don't know.
Extract 4.
If I had a family and children and everything, my children were at school and stuff, I'd have to self-censor. But I haven't. My whole childhood, I had no barriers. I could do whatever I wanted. And it's been like that throughout my life as an artist. I have done what I want to do. I have decided as I'm older, if my work isn't going to be hung in the best museums in the world because it's about taboo subjects, then so what? It doesn't matter. My art still exists and I will continue to make it. And about the subjects that I think are important, even if they're the subjects that you shouldn't be speaking about or talking about, because they're still there. They're within the ether. And if they're not brought to the surface, then they implode and there is an even greater problem.
And what's driving you on now to make more work?
Art, again, is looking after me, taking me forward. And also, I hope love is taking me forward too. So I never had so much to look forward to in all my life.
Tracy Emin, thank you very much.
Cool.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 2. Tarea 3. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Hablas español? Parlez-vous français? 你会说中文吗? If you answered si, oui, or hui, chances are you belong to the world's bilingual and multilingual majority. And besides having an easier time traveling or watching movies without subtitles, knowing two or more languages means that your brain may actually look and work differently than those of your monolingual friends. So, what does it really mean to know a language? Language ability is typically measured in two active parts, speaking and writing, and two passive parts, listening and reading. While a balanced bilingual has near equal abilities across the board in two languages, most bilinguals around the world know and use their languages in varying proportions. And depending on their situation and how they acquired each language, they can be classified into three general types. For example, let's take Gabriella, whose family immigrates to the U.S. from Peru when she's 2 years old. As a compound bilingual, Gabriella develops two linguistic codes simultaneously, with a single set of concepts, learning both English and Spanish as she begins to process the world around her. Her teenage brother, on the other hand, might be a coordinate bilingual, working with two sets of concepts, learning English in school while continuing to speak Spanish at home and with friends. Finally, Gabriella's parents are likely to be subordinate bilinguals who learn a secondary language by filtering it through their primary language. It's well known that the brain's left hemisphere is more dominant in analytical and logical processes, while the right hemisphere is more active in emotional and social ones. The fact that language involves both types of functions, while lateralization develops gradually with age, has led to the critical period hypothesis. According to this theory, children learn languages more easily because the plasticity of their developing brains lets them use both hemispheres in language acquisition, while in most adults, language is lateralized to one hemisphere, usually the left. If this is true, learning a language in childhood may give you a more holistic grasp of its social and emotional contexts. Conversely, recent research showed that people who learned a second language in adulthood exhibit less emotional bias and a more rational approach when confronting problems in the second language than in their native one. But regardless of when you acquire additional languages, being multilingual gives your brain some remarkable advantages. Some of these are even visible, such as higher density of the gray matter that contains most of your brain's neurons and synapses, and more activity in certain regions when engaging a second language. The heightened workout a bilingual brain receives throughout its life can also help delay the onset of diseases like Alzheimer's and dementia by as much as 5 years. The idea of major cognitive benefits to bilingualism may seem intuitive now, but it would have surprised earlier experts. Before the 1960s, bilingualism was considered a handicap that slowed a child's development by forcing them to spend too much energy distinguishing between languages, a view based largely on flawed studies. And while a more recent study did show that reaction times and errors increase for some bilingual students in cross-language tests, it also showed that the effort and attention needed to switch between languages triggered more activity in, and potentially strengthened, the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. This is the part of the brain that plays a large role in executive function, problem solving, switching between tasks, and focusing while filtering out irrelevant information. So, while bilingualism may not necessarily make you smarter, it does make your brain more healthy, complex, and actively engaged.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
¿Hablas español? ¿Parlez-vous français? 你会说中文吗? If you answered, sí, oui, or hui, chances are you belong to the world's bilingual and multilingual majority. And besides having an easier time traveling or watching movies without subtitles, knowing two or more languages means that your brain may actually look and work differently than those of your monolingual friends. So, what does it really mean to know a language? Language ability is typically measured in two active parts, speaking and writing, and two passive parts, listening and reading. While a balanced bilingual has near equal abilities across the board in two languages, most bilinguals around the world know and use their languages in varying proportions. And depending on their situation and how they acquired each language, they can be classified into three general types. For example, let's take Gabriella, whose family immigrates to the U.S. from Peru when she's 2 years old. As a compound bilingual, Gabriella develops two linguistic codes simultaneously, with a single set of concepts, learning both English and Spanish as she begins to process the world around her. Her teenage brother, on the other hand, might be a coordinate bilingual, working with two sets of concepts, learning English in school while continuing to speak Spanish at home and with friends. Finally, Gabriella's parents are likely to be subordinate bilinguals who learn a secondary language by filtering it through their primary language. It's well known that the brain's left hemisphere is more dominant in analytical and logical processes, while the right hemisphere is more active in emotional and social ones. The fact that language involves both types of functions while lateralization develops gradually with age has led to the critical period hypothesis. According to this theory, children learn languages more easily because the plasticity of their developing brains lets them use both hemispheres in language acquisition, while in most adults, language is lateralized to one hemisphere, usually the left. If this is true, learning a language in childhood may give you a more holistic grasp of its social and emotional contexts. Conversely, recent research showed that people who learned a second language in adulthood exhibit less emotional bias and a more rational approach when confronting problems in the second language than in their native one. But regardless of when you acquire additional languages, being multilingual gives your brain some remarkable advantages. Some of these are even visible, such as higher density of the gray matter that contains most of your brain's neurons and synapses, and more activity in certain regions when engaging a second language. The heightened workout a bilingual brain receives throughout its life can also help delay the onset of diseases like Alzheimer's and dementia by as much as 5 years. The idea of major cognitive benefits to bilingualism may seem intuitive now, but it would have surprised earlier experts. Before the 1960s, bilingualism was considered a handicap that slowed a child's development by forcing them to spend too much energy distinguishing between languages, a view based largely on flawed studies. And while a more recent study did show that reaction times and errors increase for some bilingual students in cross-language tests, it also showed that the effort and attention needed to switch between languages triggered more activity in and potentially strengthened the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. This is the part of the brain that plays a large role in executive function, problem solving, switching between tasks, and focusing while filtering out irrelevant information. So, while bilingualism may not necessarily make you smarter, it does make your brain more healthy, complex, and actively engaged.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 3. Aquí acaba la prueba de comprensión oral. Por favor, siga las instrucciones del profesorado en su aula.